cardiac cage, and that acts like a tuning capacitor. So both of them have it on the input and the output side.
Your wording suggests that you think that the diode varactor multiplier is doing all the work. It's only doing a small percentage of the work. The varactor diode, the frequency multiplying diode, creates the higher harmonics by a nonlinear action, but it takes the resonance of the local tuning coil to first put the full amount of 150 megs into the varactor and another tuning network to subtract out the third harmonic, the 450, so that the tuning of those coils, you could say, is doing more work, so to speak, than the varactor is doing as far as what's really going on in creating the third harmonic frequency and selecting it and rejecting the fundamental. So the coils are doing a hell of a lot more work than just the varactor. The varactor stops the operation off, but the coils really do all the real work. The resonance of those coils is doing all the work. Over to you, Joe.
Okay, but neither of those coils are just colors, though. And no matter how much current they're handling, if they're handling a lot, a little, or whatever, or power levels, I don't really know. Try measuring it actually with a watt meter from that 2.3 megahertz. It's very hard to measure. You really don't see it. You can't see it on a conventional watt meter. But apparently there's a lot higher current on the output than 8072 that comes out from the antenna jack. It was just a curiosity question. If you don't know the answer, you don't know. I don't know.
Eric, KE2EJ, he's been trying to tell us something. Go ahead, Eric. KE2EJ, K2LIW, go ahead, Eric.
Hit the wrong button. I need a minute, so stand by for a minute.
We're going to stand by until we hear from you.
You got about that. Stupid things running away with me. This is N2NYW. I have one question. It's in perfect shape. P-71, Crown Vic, a police interceptor. I got it off of my brother when he passed. I had no intention, but it's mint. I mean, I just need some paintwork to it, and I had all the fluids that you could think of on the bottom, even the tranny. And he didn't want to do the tranny because he said you got a lot of miles on it. The car is from Sanford, North Carolina, Center State. And as soon as he dropped the tranny pan, there was, that's all it is a magnet filter. He said it was clean as a whistle. The car runs great. But I was looking at a Ford Taurus. Right? It's a place in Jersey that they sell used police cars. And this didn't seem right. This car was a Ford Taurus. It was black. Shift on a column. You see where all the radio gear was taken out. And it had 11,000 and whatever, double sum. And what do you call it? A speedometer, it looked 160, and the horsepower was ridiculous for a four-cylinder. But if it only had 11,000 miles on it, what's the gimmick? Was the thing bashed up or something? I don't understand.
N2NYW, Ed, you're on the wrong frequency. You've either hit a knob and jumped to a frequency, or you picked up the wrong mic. You're in the middle of the technical net on LIMOG, which we've been on this frequency, 146.85, for the last 34 years, every Sunday night. This is a technical net where we discuss radio things, not necessarily do we discuss cars. So you're not part of this conversation, you're interrupting it, and I think either your rig has dropped to the wrong frequency, or you picked up the wrong microphone. N2NYW, and you've been timing out the machine, by the way. N2NYW, K2RIW, my name is Dick, and this is part of the LIMOG Technical Net on Sunday night. Back to you, Ed.
Dick, I'm very sorry. Extremely sorry and embarrassed. I'm so sorry. Yeah, I know you've been around forever. I remember you. So let me jump out of here before I'll catch you down the log. Thank you, sir. N2NYW clear.
Don't worry, Ed. You're forgiven. We've all made mistakes like this from time to time. Okay, we've been through Joe's question. Now, three times in a row in the last 6 months, three times, Freddie, KB2VBN, signs in. And when we get around to going to him, he's not there. I hope that Freddie's going to be there tonight. KB2VBN from Far Rockaway, K2RIW. Go ahead, Freddie.
Roger, this is KB2VBN. I have a question, two questions. Buzz Aldrin asked tonight, was he a ham radio operator? If he was, what type of radio did he use? And number two, the old shortwave frequencies that played the old shows like Dick Tracy and Shadow and what's his name? I'm trying to remember. Dick Tracy, the Shadow, and I forgot the other one. But what frequencies do it come on? Do they still operate on the AM frequencies?
Yeah, the Shadow Knows and Dick Tracy and those are the older programs that were on AM radio way back in the 40s and the 50s. I don't think those shows exist anywhere anymore, except for somebody's recording. That's my first guess. And your first, that was your second question. Your first question was something about, is somebody doing something with ham radio? So repeat that one, Freddie. You're a little bit weak on the input, and occasionally I miss some of the words. You're a little weak on coming through the machine. I occasionally miss some of the words. I'm actually hearing you a little bit better on the input than I'm hearing you through the machine. KB2VPN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Freddie. Hello, Freddie. It's your turn to transmit. I'm hearing you on the input when you're there, but you're not transmitting right now, Freddie. Freddie, they're playing your song. KB2VBN, K2RIW, go right ahead.
This is KB2VBN.
I'm hearing you now. I just heard your call letters. Go right ahead. Please repeat your first question, Red Freddie, because I missed some of the key words the first time you gave it to us. You've got it, Freddie, right now.
If there's an astronaut named Buzz Aldrin. Buzz Aldrin. He was an astronaut way, way back in the days. I think it was back in the 30s or something like that. I want to know if he was a ham radio operator and what was his call sign?
Let's see now. Apollo 11, the first landing on the moon, was Armstrong, Aldrin, and Collins. So Aldrin, Buzz Aldrin, was the second man who set foot on the moon. Is Buzz Aldrin a ham radio operator? No, he is not. I wish he is, but I'm pretty sure he was not and maybe never was a ham radio operator. Buzz Aldrin, Apollo 11, second man on the moon right after Neil Armstrong. Back to you, Freddie. KB2VBN, K2RIW on the TechNet.
Hey, Roger. It looked like I saw him on TV about three or four months ago. It looked like I saw him. He's still living. He's got to still be living.
Yeah, I'm guessing he was around 35 years of age in 1969. So that was now 48 years ago. At 48 years, so I'm guessing his age then was at least 30 or 35, because he had a whole lot of military experience before becoming an astronaut. So he's around 90 years of age right now, but he's still reasonably active, and he's trying very hard to talk NASA into putting more dedication to going to Mars. He's a very strong Mars enthusiast. Back to you, Eddie. And too bad he's Freddie. And too bad he never got a ham license, to my knowledge. KB2VBN, K2RIW.
Hey, Roger. Yeah, I'm about to do more research on him. Yeah, I was wondering, yeah. Yeah, because I went to several episodes, so they, you know, asked a lot of questions about people in the, you know, Air Force and astronauts in the beginning. You know, so I was curious about it.
Yeah, a hell of a lot of the astronauts do have a ham license today. I bet you half the guys who go to the International Space Station today have a ham license. But in those days, the original Apollo, Mercury, and Gemini astronauts, very small percentage of them were hams in those days. Owen Garriott did go to both Skylab and the Space Shuttle. Owen Garriott, K5, can't think of his call letters. And during one of his Space Shuttle missions, he talked to a lot of ham radio operators. I was one of them, supposedly. That is to say, he could recognize my call letters in the noise of a tape recording. And so, in theory, I had a QSO with him. But it wasn't a really good two-way QSO. Okay, I think we've gone down the list of everybody who signed in, who's still awake tonight. And I think we're going to go over to Dr. Roy. Let me drop. Our second section of our schedule for the TechNet is the what some of us call is the physics and science section that Dr. Roy, AC2GS, covers. And there's a chance he's going to talk about Doppler tonight. And there's a lot more going on with Doppler shift than first meets the eye. I think Roy's going to give us some of that information, if that's the subject he selects, and it's his choice. And you're also supposed to talk to Roy by way of the mailbag. If you, he's going to give you the address for how you send your question to Roy, and he almost guarantees you're going to get an answer. On top of that, you're allowed to pose to him the subjects that you'd like to have the science and physics section, or middle section of the TechNet cover. You're allowed to make suggestions, and I guarantee he'll do his best to follow. AC2GS. Dr. Roy, K2RIW. You got it, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS. I only get one question to answer. I just want to tell people that the email address that they can reach me at is technet@limarktech.net. Again, technet@limarktech.net. Or you can look me up on QRZ. The call sign is AC2GS. And any question, ham-related questions for Dick, physics-related questions for me and Dick and Paul and anyone else who wants to answer. Let me drop. I just want to give you a couple of links that might be of interest to you guys. I've been reading a bunch of books on physics, and one of them is The Physics of Everyday Things, The Extraordinary Science Behind Ordinary Day, and that's a very nice description of how all these little gadgets that we use, how they actually work. And there's another one called We Have No Idea, A Guide to the Unknown Universe, which points out all the things that we don't have a clue about. Anyway, both of those things are on a webpage. You just go to books.limarktech.net. And I'll be maintaining a book list. They're both very good books, and think about them if you like to read. So tonight's subject is the wonderful world of Dopplers. Now, everyone has heard about Dopplers. They certainly know them in the radars that traffic cops use to give you tickets. They've heard the example, and most people have heard the whistle as a train goes by. It speeds up in a high frequency pitch, and then it leaves and gets low, and to them that's Doppler. So the phenomena is that as the velocity is different between the listener and the creator of waves, changes its frequency and its wavelength. That's why it speeds up as it comes towards you, and it gets a lower frequency as it goes away from you. So the question for the audience, if you'll play with me, is it a symmetrical phenomena? In other words, if you put the whistle that usually goes on the train on a stationary object and you sit on top of the train as it passes by, do you hear the same thing going on? So the big question is, Are Dopplers symmetrical or asymmetrical? And if you keep your answer short, I guarantee you, you will be right.
You might want to explain what you mean by symmetrical. Are you saying that as you pass by, or as it passes by you, the emitter, the number of hertz of increase when it's approaching you and the number of hertz of decrease when it's moving away from you, is it the same magnitude? Is that what you mean by symmetrical? Over to you, Dr. Roy.
Yes, indeed. Another way of looking at it is if you close your eyes and I put you on the train versus if you close your eyes and you're sitting next to the train, is there any frequency difference? Is it discernible? Now, it may or may not be discernible to the human ear, but you happen to be a sneaky guy and you have a recorder with you that has a frequency meter on it. So you can tell how many, what the frequency goes up to and what the frequency goes down to. So that's what I mean by symmetrical. It's the same operation in either direction. So anyone want to play my game?
My goodness, you guys are bashful. There must be somebody out there with a guess as to whether or not it is or is not symmetrical, and maybe why.
Come on, George. Go for it.
Yeah, that sounds like a perfect question for Mr. FIU.
I still don't get the question.
The question is, does the frequency shift that the Doppler gives you. You're standing by a train, there's a whistle on the train, you have a frequency meter that you're looking at, and you see the frequency of the whistle as it comes towards you, reaches you, and then goes away, and you write the numbers down. Now we switch places. You're sitting on top of the train, the whistle is now stationary on the track. You have the same frequency meter, and the train goes in the same exact path it went before. Are the frequencies the same? Are the frequencies different? Is it symmetrical? Is it asymmetrical?
Okay, WS Twin says it's equal. I'd say definitely equal.
Okay, anyone else have any opinion?
November 2, Zulu Charlie, going with equal.
Okay, we have two for equal. Anyone who goes for unequal?
Principle of amplification.
I didn't catch all that, George. Could you please say it again?
The principle of amplification, KD2FIU.
Okay, what does the principle of amplification tell you? Is Doppler shift symmetrical or an asymmetrical operation?
Let's go with everybody else who answered first.
By symmetrical or not symmetrical, I said it wrong before. What Dr. Roy is saying is that if the receiver is moving and the emitter is stationary, that's one situation. If you reverse the situation, if the receiver is not moving, it's stationary, but the whistle is moving. In those two cases, whistle moving and the receiver stationary, or vice versa, do you get the exact same amount of Doppler in the two cases? That's what Roy means by symmetrical. And it looks like we've got three people right now saying, no matter which way you do it, you're going to get the same amount of Doppler. That's a symmetrical. That's what I think you guys are guessing. Maybe with any further guesses, or if you want to change your guess, give us your call letters right now. K2RIW listening.
FIU, I'm not saying yes. I'm saying it's the principle.
Okay, George, you're giving us extraneous information. It's amplification. Is it symmetrical, yes or no? Give us a yes or a no, or a maybe. Over to you, George.
Maybe.
Okay, George has given us a very strong maybe. You got it right.
Okay, very well. Well, the point is that in some cases, Doppler effects are symmetrical, and in other cases, they're not symmetrical. So I'll give you the cases that are asymmetrical. The case that I brought for the train tracks and the train and such is actually asymmetrical. Although the frequency will go up as the train reaches you and go down as it goes away from you, the frequencies that it shifts to are different depending upon whether the source is stationary or the source is mobile. So that's asymmetric. Now, all the guys that point their telescopes out there in interstellar space and look for Doppler shifts that they're looking for in that case are very symmetrical. If you went the other way, you'd get the same Doppler shifts. Does anyone have any kind of inkling why one should be symmetrical and the other one asymmetrical? Since I told you which, it's a little bit easier to kind of come up with what's the difference between the two.
N2A3R.
Six.
Does it have something to do with the distance between the transmitter that's transmitting the signal and the receiver? Is it the distance between them?
No, unfortunately, it's not the distance. It's something else that's different in the two examples.
So Golf 2 Charlie with an answer. E2FIU.
Malen first, then you, George.
Okay, thank you, Roy. Well, in the case where your whistle is stationary, the whistle is obviously whistling, so you have all your waves, and those are traveling through the air. Your medium is stationary, whereas if you put the whistle on the train, the whistle would be moving through the air. That changes things, because it's moving through the medium. That's why it would be asymmetrical in this example. Back to your Roy from Kilo Golf 2 Charlie.
Hey, Malen, George wanted to say something. George?
The only variable here is velocity of the traveling source.
Well, yes, the nature of trains versus galaxies, the speed is significantly different. But Malen was actually correct. The difference is that one travels through a medium and the other does not travel through a medium. And when you have something that travels through a medium, that medium itself can have a relative velocity involved in this complicating nature. And that's why the train, you have to calculate the additional perturbation of the velocity of the air, which is different if the sound source is stationary or the sound source is moving. So it's the medium that's the message, if you will. Let me drop.
I'm going to add a couple of words to that. The sound doesn't travel unless there's air to convey the sound. Astronauts in the space cannot talk to each other if the radio is not working. In the vacuum of space, sound doesn't go. So air is required. That's the medium for sound. But when it comes to electromagnetic waves, radio and light coming from a star, electromagnetic waves does not require a medium. The vacuum of space that contains nothing will convey a light wave beautifully. That light wave from the sun to the earth goes through the nothingness of space. And therefore, because electromagnetic waves require no medium, that Doppler is completely symmetrical. No matter who moves, no matter who's stationary, doesn't matter. You get the same answer. But in the case of air, depending on who's moving faster or slower to the air, makes a difference in the amount of Doppler you get. That's one way I word it. Roy probably has a better way of wording it. You got it, Roy.
N2HVR, quick question.
Go, Nick.
Hi, Happy New Year to everybody, by the way. I work amateur satellites, the LEO satellites, and I've been working a new one called AO91. Just to make it brief, I'm not going to get into details, but when I transmit, I transmit up on 435, 250, and receive down at 145 to 960, whatever. I have a Doppler shift on the transmit because I'm using UHF. Now, the radio frequency between me and the satellite is actually going through space and then going through the air. But there is a Doppler shift. As the satellite approaches me, I have to change the frequency on my transmit or receive, sometimes both, to stay on frequency with the satellite. And then as the satellite leaves me or passes overhead and then goes away from me, I also have to adjust. Usually as it's coming towards me, I decrease the difference in frequency. And then as it leaves me, I add maybe 5 kc. Back to Nick.
Nick, we're not saying that that light and electromagnetism doesn't have a Doppler shift. We're just saying that the Doppler shift is the same whether you do it in the way that you do it, or if you reversed it and you were sitting on the satellite and someone else was sitting on a radio where you are. That's all that we're saying, that it's symmetrical. And one of the reasons it's symmetrical is that you don't have to complicate matters by the medium which the wave goes through having its own velocity, since, unfortunately for some people, light doesn't have a medium. There's no such thing as an ether. Now, one second, let it drop for a minute. Back in the late 1800s, there was a famous, I really mean famous, experiment called the Michelson-Morley, in which they did a very, very smart experiment that proved that there was no ether, that there was no medium in space from which light traveled. Now, we look upon that as a great experiment that showed a great truth. But those guys thought it was a terrible disaster because they weren't looking for that. They were looking to prove ether. They kept on trying to prove ether into the middle of the 19th century. They were really upset with this. And so historically we kind of lose that because success is success. But as far as Michelson was concerned, it was a complete failure, and he kept on doing different experiments to demonstrate an ether, which we'll get into hopefully in a few minutes.
You got it, Eric.
Two things. One is, I'm just curious, the satellite, the new satellite is where I haven't been keeping up. Whether that's a linear transponder or an FM transponder, that's one thing. Cause you get a little bit of leeway if you're doing FM. If you have a linear transponder, like I always used to do, I actually wrote a program which would calculate the Doppler shift to the radio for me, and that's ultimately the best way. I mean, there are a number of positioning programs out there that will do that for you. And the other thing is, if you look at radio books in the 20s and the 30s, and even into the 40s, they still mention the word ether, but it's a joke.
Roy, in the case of Michelson-Morley, I am guessing what they did is they set up a very fancy Wheatstone bridge, or actually a Michelson interferometer. But they set up an interferometer measuring the speed of propagation, so to speak, between point A and point B. And if they chose the time when the Earth's going around the Sun and you're on the part of the Earth that's facing forward, they expected to get one kind of Doppler. And if you did it 12 hours later when the part of the Earth is now facing away from the direction that we're going around the Sun at a drastically different velocity, so to speak, the other direction, they expected to get the opposite Doppler. And they got no Doppler at all. There was no ether that they were traveling through. A medium that the radio wave or the light wave traveled through, called ether, wasn't there. And that's what I think you're saying really upset the daylights out of them, because they started off absolutely positive there would be an ether, and Mother Nature wouldn't demonstrate that ether to them. Mother Nature kept holding it a secret. Over you, Roy, KQIW.
Surprised, amazed, confused, and annoyed the heck out of them all. And the Michelson interferometer has been slowly being upgraded over the last century. They've replaced the light source with a laser beam. There's a beam splitter. And now, if you look in the books, and I'll give you a link if you want to look in the books, it's a very interesting device. It has a beam splitter. It has two very long lengths going at right angles to each other with a mirrored end that bounces back into another beam splitter and looks for an interference pattern. And if you happen by the gravity wave interferometer that's so famous, the LIGO interferometer that's now picking up gravity waves. It is basically a Michelson interferometer. So the distortions that they wanted, he wanted to pick up in ether, is actually being picked up in the way of gravity waves. So, and another point, although ether, what they thought ether was, is didn't exist, unfortunately. But you know, there's a way of looking upon space as a series of fields, and that there's no such thing as a true vacuum of nothingness. That the very vacuum of space is filled with fields, electron fields, neutron fields, all kind of wonderful fields. So in a way there is an ether, and in a way the Michelson interferometer actually found something 100 years later. It found gravity waves, which is nice.
WS2N.
We're going to go over to Paul in a second. That LIGO interferometer is one hell of an interferometer. Each individual arm is 4 kilometers long. One arm is north-south, so to speak.
Repeater, timeout.
One arm is north-south, the other arm is east-west. Each arm is 4 kilometers long of a great big long vacuum tube, the best vacuum they can create, so that the laser beam is not going through any air, it's going through vacuum. It doesn't get disturbed with temperature and so on. And on each arm, the laser beam is bouncing back and forth 400 times before it comes back to the summing device to be canceled. So 400 times 4 miles, that's a hell of a lot of kilometers that signal is going through, and they're looking for an extremely subtle amount because those gravity waves are coming from a billion light years away, hundreds of light years away. Over to you, Paul. WS2N, K2LAW, and the group.
Yeah, okay. Well, what Roy brings up is very good because it led to, that Michelson experiment led to this Sagnac effect, the George Sagnac. He was a guy that he used the interferometer as well. He had the setup where he could split the beam, but instead of running it linear, he ran it in a on it like on a table, and he has the two mirrors, you know, one opposite one, you know, one another, and light rays going in the opposite direction from one another, and he would be able to measure the difference. You know, everything was the same, but if you could spin the whole table, this whole contraption, it didn't matter if you spun it clockwise or counterclockwise, it would change it. And by doing this, eventually it led to modern day gyroscopes, you know, for aircraft and rockets and all. So Sagnac, so one experiment actually led to a very practical use for that. Back to you, sir.
Back to Roy. And by the way, Roy, nowadays there's a kind of a ring interferometer that's used with a laser beam going through it, that's used modern day as a massless gyroscope, so to speak. It measures angular velocity of rotation of an aircraft by way of a ring of a laser beam going into an interferometer-like structure. AC2GS, K2LIW, you got it right.
Dick, that's what I was talking about. That's what Sagnac led to.
Yes, indeed, Dick and Paul, you are both right, and I have links to all these things, by the way. If you type in ring.limartech.net, you will get a description of the ring interferometer. Sagnac designed that and built that and ran that in 1913, and was he planning on making a solid-state or non-moving gyroscope? No. Guess what he was trying to do? He was trying to prove that there was ether. Yeah, he was pals with good old Michelson, and they were still looking for that darn ether. So they came up with something incredibly useful for a completely other reason. And that's how science very often works. So again, ring.limartech.net will get you about the ring interferometer. Ether.limartech.net will give you a nice little article on the ether, and Doppler.limartech.net will give you a nice little summary of the magic of the Doppler effect.
In 1913, he did the right thing. He did it for the wrong reasons, Roy.
And that is where genius is involved. If you do it for the wrong thing, and sometimes great things happen. I mean, it goes all the way back to Fleming and the penicillin that he found in a dirty Petri dish. So it's smart guys who figure out their mistake and build on it.
In the case of that ring interferometer, the acceleration, the gyroscopic-like action they're trying to detect is so extremely small compared to the speed of light that the laser beam is going. And I guess the ring has a signal going around clockwise and another thing going around counterclockwise, and I'm guessing they beat the two against each other with such an extremely small fraction of the speed of light. I'm amazed that that thing is able to detect. And I guess the great advantage of a laser gyroscope is that probably has a hell of a lot less drift compared to a real mechanical gyroscope. Over to you, Roy.
Well, one of the beauties of a laser ring interferometer is it doesn't have to be recalibrated. It's self-calibrating. So that alone is a great labor-saving device.
Okay. You have to set it to zero when you know that no rotation is taking place. And then you can calibrate. At the time you're zeroing it, how do you know that there's no rotation of the aircraft taking place?
Well, you have to know your frame of reference. As long as you know your frame of reference is an inertial one, you're in good shape. If you don't have the faintest idea, then you can't set the device up in the first place. But it doesn't require the fine-tuning calibrations of using incoherent light. That's the benefit of using a laser. And, they started with simply a bunch of mirrors that bent each other around in a kind of quad shape. But nowadays, they use optical fiber, and they just wind it around and around and around many times, almost like an inductor. And they get a very good response from that.
Uh-huh. What's your guess as to how many miles of fiber allows them to have enough sensitivity in that ring of fiber optics, Roy?
Here's where me not being an engineer gets me into trouble, because I really don't know the specific numbers. It's a given that as you make the length longer and longer and longer, you give an increased sensitivity. But by what factor, I unfortunately don't know.
WS2N.
I'm guessing each ring gives you a certain amount of deviation, and if you double the number of rings, you get double amount of deviation. So if they've got 10,000 rings of that fiber, then they're 10,000 times more sensitive. WS2N, K2RW, you've got it, Paul.
I've never seen the ones they use on the jets, on the fighter jets, but I have seen pictures of the ones on the boosters, and they look quite small. So, we're talking about, a component that's maybe 3 inches by 3 inches, a box that big. So it's mounted, you mount two of them perpendicular to one another, and you can, you can figure out the roll and the yaw, that type of thing. And if you even add a third one, you can have backup ones. And that's what all these boosters are using now. So they're quite small. So I've never actually seen the coil itself, so I can't tell you how many feet or miles they have to use of that. But it's beneficial because, it's set up on the ground. And after that, after they install it, you don't have to worry about any mechanical moving parts whatsoever. So nothing to break down.
If I was setting up a laser ring gyroscope system, I'd like to be able to measure specific amount of yaw, pitch, and roll compared to a reference. I'd like to measure the amount of velocity of yaw, pitch, and roll. I'd like to measure the amount of acceleration of yaw, pitch, and roll. your knowledge, Roy, does that laser gyroscope measure all of those parameters with no drift on all of them and self-calibrating on all of them? AC2GS, K2LIW?
Yeah, it's my understanding it does all of those things. You just have to get three in the proper plane. But the whole concept is that it detects angular velocity. So once you're able to detect an angular velocity, you can detect the velocity. You can detect the change in the velocity. And if you have the three components, you can do everything in three-dimensional space that you would need.
Yeah, I have to integrate velocity in order to get position. So any small amount of error in the answer of the velocity of a measurement, let's say I'm measuring roll, and I'm measuring roll velocity, call it roll rate, and if there's any error in the roll rate, and I'm now going to integrate it to get roll position, I'm now going to accumulate an error in position if there's any error in the measurement of making it. And hopefully these things have got 10 to the minus 14 error rate. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW.
It's not so much error rate as it is precision. If you wrap enough fiber optic cable, and a fiber optic cable is very thin, so you can wrap it a lot, you can get the sensitivity and the accuracy up to a significant enough number that they're actually using it. So it's kind of it's a proof is that it's a used item. It's not something sitting on a scientist's desk trying to figure out how to monetize it. So it is possible because it is being done.
Now, look out, Roy. I've got a very complicated question for you. The problem of medium. If you and I were setting up the experiment that we talked about some time ago, where I put a sound emitter on the nose of an airplane, I put a sound detector on the leading edge of the vertical stabilizer of an airplane. So I've got a sound detector at the tail, and I've got a sound emitter at the nose. And I'm now going to fly my airplane at some nice high speed. And I'm going to measure Doppler shifts, so to speak. Well, because there is no delta velocity between the nose and the tail, because the airplane is not stretching, I'm not going to get any Doppler. However, depending on whether the emitter is in the tail or the emitter is in the nose and the receiver is on the other end, as I fly the airplane at a very fast speed through the air, which is the medium, I get two very different answers. The most significant answer is if the emitter is in the tail and the receiver is in the nose. As I fly the airplane very fast, the signal going from the tail through that fast-moving air to the nose, let me drop, has to go through more and more air before it gets there. Therefore, the signal that gets to the nose is going to be weaker and weaker. No Doppler shift. The signal has to go through more and more air when I fly faster and faster. Therefore, the signal has more delay time, and it's going to be weaker. So in the case of the medium that I'm doing my Doppler detection through, if the medium is moving, I get this peculiar effect in one direction versus the other direction. Okay. In the case of the fiber optics, that is the medium is now moving. Let me drop. However, if I did the experiment with a laser beam between nose and tail of the airplane, I could fly the airplane at the speed of light. This is a very fancy spaceship. I can move it at the speed of light. Because no medium is required for the laser beam, I could be doing it in free space. The signal going from nose to tail and tail to nose would be no different. No medium is required, and I'm now flying as fast as I like, and I get no Doppler, no change in amplitude. In other words, the nose and the tail detector and emitter, in the case of a laser beam, doesn't know that the spacecraft is moving. Okay? In the case of the laser beam going through the fiber optics, the amount of length of fiber optics between the transmitter and the receiver is not changing. And therefore, how does the laser beam going through the optics know that the outside world is moving? How does it know that? AC2GS, K2LIW.
The problem was that when they did the ring interferometer, it showed what we're talking about now. And at first they said, aha, we have proved ether. And then, unfortunately, Albert Einstein said, no, you have proved special relativity.
I think you're going to have to give us a few more words on this one, Roy. You've got a nice mental picture as to what's going on. We're not inside your head. You're going to have to describe all this to us. Good, Roy.
Okay. As you put an angular momentum on a circular path of light in two different directions, they discern an interference pattern, because in a non-relativistic reality, they would go at the same speed and they'd cancel out and the rotating of it would have no effect. But since this special relativity, the rotation is having a distortion of the timing of the light path, and the distortion is being represented by the interference patterns that are changing secondary to the angular velocity that you're introducing into the system. It's special relativity. Special relativity sometimes is not the easiest thing to explain to people, unfortunately, because the concept of time and space being relative upsets most people.
Okay, let me show you the problem that I've got, Roy, and maybe you can clear this up for me and maybe other people. I've got two spacecraft out there. One of them is emitting a laser beam, and the other one's receiving it. The amount of Doppler shift I get in space, in the vacuum of space, is only a function of the rate of change of the distance between the two spacecraft. It doesn't matter if the transmitting spacecraft is moving and the other spacecraft is stationary or vice versa. No matter who moves, no matter who receives, whether the signal is going north to south or south to north, in the case of two spacecraft, only the rate of change of distance between the two spacecraft makes the Doppler. The two spacecraft could both be moving at the speed of light. If the distance between the two is not changing, the Doppler would be zero. So when no medium is required, only relative distance change gives you Doppler. Let me drop. The length of that fiber on the clockwise going signal and the length of the fiber on the counterclockwise signal is not changing. It's the equivalent of the two spacecraft not changing their distance. Therefore, you would think they would both have zero Doppler. The outside world is moving, so to speak, because the whole aircraft is rotating in yaw, we're going to say. And therefore, the clockwise signal is going to speed up and the counterclockwise signal is going to slow down. Why should they slow down when they're going through an equal length of fiber and the length of the fiber is not changing? Therefore, the apparent distance between transmitter and receiver is not changing. So why should there be a Doppler in that fiber? AC2GS, K2RIW.
WS2N.
UFIU.
Hey, Dick, let them both go and then I'll discuss it some more.
Call for his great ball, wait for the beep.
If you're thinking about the fiber, that's harder to picture what Roy's talking about. If you picture with the two mirrors and the spinning, gigantic spinning table, if you launch a beam one way toward one mirror to the left, and you know, you split it, and then the other beam is going to go to the other mirror to the right, right after it leaves the, right after it splits and right as it's moving, if this table is moving, turning to the, let's say, clockwise direction, the mirror on the left, in a certain amount of time will now be further away from where that beam originally started. And in that same amount of time as it's turning, the other mirror will be now closer to the location where the beam got split. So that one on the left is going to take is going to travel a longer path in the same amount of time to get to the first mirror then the second mirror that's moving toward the location where the beam got split. That's the way I looked at it. Back to you, Dick.
Before we go over to George, let me drop this. I wonder if we're seeing a Coriolis effect here. If you and I are on opposite sides of a carousel, and I, while the carousel is rotating, is moving, I try to throw a baseball from me to you. With reference to you and me, that baseball will look like it's curving. It doesn't go straight from me to you. I threw it directly at you, and if the carousel is going counterclockwise, the net result is that you will think the ball is curving strongly to the right, and it's going to miss you. So, in the case of the beam on this rotating table, going to two mirrors, one's going to split it to the right, one's going to split it to the left, is the beam going to arrive not directly on target, but steered by the Coriolis effect because the table is rotating? Is that part of what's going on here, Paul, from what you have read? WS2N, K2LIW?
No, not from what I read. The beam is not being affected by, you know, any spinning motion. The beam is going actually straight. You know, in the original design, the dog neck effect would be the beam is going straight, and, you know, if they're launched at the same time, and this table turns now, by the time it gets to that one mirror that's going away from you, you know, on a turning the table, so it's now going away from you, it takes longer to get there. You know, you're assuming, you know, they're shooting a straight beam in that direction. The other beam is now going toward the other mirror that happens to be coming towards you. So by the time they, you know, go over to, let's say, where second base would be, you know, and then completely go around that whole setup, the, you know, bouncing off those three mirrors and then coming back to, let's call it, home plate, the one is going to take basically a longer path than the other one.
There's something not clear here, Paul. Wait a minute. Is all the LASA hardware, transmitter, mirrors, receivers, is everything locked down to a plate? Nothing is moving with reference to the plate. And if the plate is not rotating, all of these signals going clockwise and counterclockwise give you zero Doppler. And now everything is locked down to the plate, screwed down tight, and the hold-on plate and all the hardware is rotated. You didn't say those words, but is that the device you're describing, Paul? WS2N, K2LIW?
That's right. You have a big round table, you know, and you can spin this thing as fast as you want. And on top of it is everything. The laser beam, the mirrors are mounted in place, the splitter, you know, where it gets split, and the detector. In fact, you could even put the batteries, you know, the power supply, everything. Everything's on this one board. It's the same idea as, now, you shrink everything, and now you put it on a booster, and you'll be able to tell which way the booster is rolling. It's the same thing. Everything is all on that one table, yes.
Now, Roy, the experiment done in 1913, where the Earth is rotating clockwise or counterclockwise or in the direction that the Earth is moving around the Sun. In one case, it's in the positive direction. In the other case, it's in the negative direction. And they saw no Doppler. There was no ether. And now on this rotating plate, all of a sudden, it acts like there is an ether. Do you see the paradox here, Roy? AC2GS, K2LAW?
Radiation admission.
The fact is that they thought they did see an ether because they did see a difference, but they had the wrong reason for it, and hopefully my description will be a little bit better this time. Let's take the fiber optics out of it. Let's just use mirrors and ether. And so when the box is stationary, it's not rotating, what is the speed of light traveling at, would you say?
I guess the answer is C. And now, If the hold on plate is in free space and I accelerate it to half the speed of light and don't do any further acceleration, it's now moving at half the speed of light compared to the Earth, we'll say, and I remake a measurement. I don't think I'm going to measure anything. Over to you, Roy.
Yeah, but you have to realize that that's not what's going on. What's going on is you are rotating it angularly, and you have two beams of light in going in opposite directions. So where you're spinning it makes a difference. If you're spinning it for one stream of light versus the other stream of light, you're going to pick up relativistic interference patterns.
Okay, I've got a problem. Let me show you.
Amplification.
I've got two spacecraft in space. They're each, let me pick a number, 10 kilometers apart. The distance between the two is not changing. But the two spacecraft are moving at half the speed of light away from the center of our solar system. They're moving at half the speed of light. The distance between the two is not changing. From the lead spacecraft, I've got a red laser beam going to a red detector in the trailing spacecraft. From the trailing spacecraft, I got a blue laser beam going from the trailing spacecraft toward the leading spacecraft. So I've got a red laser beam going backwards. I've got a blue laser beam going forward. And I measure Doppler shift, time delay, whatever, between the two. Because there's no change in the distance between the two, I say I'm not going to measure any difference. Whether the two spacecraft are moving, reference to the inertial reference of the universe, or not moving, nothing changes. As long as I didn't change the distance, the physical distance between the two, I get a zero delta measurement. How does that differ from this rotating table with fixed distances everywhere? Over to you, Roy, K2LAW.
Amplification.
George.
It's not just a light signal. It's a light signal stimulated by amplification.
I think I'm going to see that the laser thing on this table can measure acceleration, but it cannot measure angular velocity. In the case of acceleration, all kinds of crazy Doppler things happen. But with fixed distances between point A and point B, where the medium is not required in free space for a light beam, there is no Doppler. So you're only getting Doppler due to acceleration. I'm beginning to think the ring laser gyroscope can measure acceleration. It cannot measure angular velocity other than by accumulating acceleration and integrating, so to speak. It cannot directly measure velocity, angular velocity. I think it can only measure acceleration of angle. That's my guess, though, Roy. I wonder if you agree or disagree. AC2GS, K2LAW.
Well, I don't know. I think I read that it basically reads angular velocity, not acceleration. I am going to definitely read more about it because I didn't think we were going to kind of go that much into the ring interferometer. But I don't know what to tell you. I mean, it's not quite the same as the two rocket ships, because the two rocket ships are in, relatively speaking, zero velocity from each other. They're in their own reference points immovable, so they're stationary. Whereas you have a somewhat different situation where you have an angular rotation going around with two paths of light going in opposite directions. So I don't know if that's an equivalent to situation.
VDH with a comment.
VDH recognized. Stand by a second. I think it measures angular position by integrating velocity. Let me show you why I say that. You admitted that those two spacecraft, which have a fixed distance between each other, whether the two of them together are moving at half the speed of light or not moving at all, I get no Doppler. I'm now going to put those two spacecraft on a very large carousel One of them is going to be at the 12 o'clock position, one of them is going to be at the 3 o'clock position. And now I'm going to rotate the carousel very fast clockwise. Between those two spacecraft, am I going to measure a relative Doppler? I think the answer is no. The fact that I've got a fixed distance